Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to the second half of Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keys. You can become a fan of the show. Look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys on Facebook. And if you have any questions for today's show, you can call in. The call-in number is 646-929-0368. I just got off the phone from a guest in the UK and a guest in Haiti. We're talking about glaucoma awareness. Please make sure that as part of your New Year's resolution, go get your eyes checked out. Glaucoma is one of those secret stealth illnesses that will sneak up on you and you will no longer be able to see, literally. So please make that part of your New Year's resolution and get your eyes checked out. Some wonderful organizations, PreventBlindness.org and the International Glaucoma Association. Their website is glaucoma-association.com. But right now, I'm going to be speaking to a wonderful, talented author and professor, Thabiti Lewis. He teaches in the English department at WSUV. He is the author of Ballers of the New School, Race, Sport, and American Culture. You got to pick up a copy of this book. Now, of course, I'm going to be giving away a copy of this book, and I'll tell you a little later how you can win a copy. But if you don't win, you still need to go to the store and pick up this brother's book. He is just really laying it down and educating you on what's going on in sports today, in the past, and what can happen in the future. I just want to read it before I reach out to him. I just want to read something. This is actually from a narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass. And he quotes Frederick Douglass in his book, but this is something I wanted to read. I thought was pertinent to today's conversation. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, and it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them, and these will continue until they are resisted with either words or blows or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress. In the light of these ideas, Negroes will be hunted at the North and held and flogged at the South. So long as they submit to those devilish outrages and make no resistance, either moral or physical. Men may not get all they pay for in this world, but they must certainly pay for all they get. If we ever get free from the oppressions and wrongs heaped upon us, we must pay for their removal. We must do this by labor, by suffering, by sacrifice, and if need be, by our lives and the lives of others. Well, I hope that gave you a little taste of what we're about to get into today. So if you don't have your boxing gloves on, if you haven't been practicing your dribble, if you can hit the tennis ball, maybe you want to check into another show, because today we're really going to hit the court with some serious stuff here with Thabiti Lewis. I'm going to reach out to him on the phone. Let me just tell you, as I'm calling his number, some of the things that people are saying about his book. Ballers of the New School is indeed an apropos title for Thabiti Lewis's challenging and innovative take on a new generation of black athletes, punctuated with striking candor and an adroit understanding of contemporary popular culture. Lewis's Ballers of the New School is a much-needed addition to scholarship on race and sports. That's just some of what they're saying. Let me read something else they're saying here about him. Coming out of a nowhere like a Mike Tyson uppercut, Thabiti Lewis's Ballers of the New School is a shock to the system. Rarely has the intersection of sports and race been discussed with such bracing honesty, such generosity, such anger born of love. It is an absolute stunner. So those are some of the things that people are saying. So you definitely want to pick up a copy of Mr. Lewis's, actually he's a professor, Professor Lewis's book, Ballers of the New School. He goes through a lot here. We're not going to be able to touch on everything in his book today, but we'll try to touch on many things and some solutions. Good morning. This is Joy Keyes. I'm trying to reach Professor Lewis.
Sabidi, how are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I kind of had a
Can you hear me?
I can. Let me try and
okay.
turn it up a little bit.
Yeah, because you're a little low for us. I hope the listeners can hear you. If you're in the chat room, let me know if you can or can't hear him, and
okay.
we'll try to figure out what we can do. But good morning, Sabidi.
Good morning. Uh-oh. How's that? Is it a little staticky or no?
Yeah, I hear a little static, but you're okay. Let's keep going.
Okay.
So I want to tell you I'm mad at you, okay? I just want to tell you that right off the bat.
Why is that?
What you doing stirring up some mess? Wasn't everything cool? You know, like you say, I just wanted to watch the game, enjoy the plays, you know, yell and scream, you know, curse a little bit, maybe here and there. But you gotta write this book and make me start thinking and make me start questioning, make me start wondering about all the stuff I've been, the propaganda I've been force-fed. I'm a little mad at you right now.
I bet you are not alone. Being upset with me, because I know many people are expressing that same sentiment. But you know, it's interesting. I didn't do it. That's all I keep saying is that I did not do it. It wasn't my call. I'm just looking at what's out there. You know.
You did not do it. You did not do it. Well, let me start in the beginning here. I met you at a book signing. I'm familiar with your friends with your sister. And I will tell you, I have become enamored with you, though. I was mad at you in the beginning, like my teenage daughter was mad with me when she went to go see certain movies. And after the movie, she's like, Mom, so did you like the movie? And I'm like, well, yeah, it was okay, but this, that, and the other, blah, blah, blah. And, oh, Mom, okay, now you just messed up my whole movie experience. You know, I mean, you know, as a parent, and you're a parent, when you go watch things and you're watching, I think we're hypersensitive, but not in a bad way. We're just looking out for our kids, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the truth. I mean, in humor, there's truth, and unfortunately, sometimes the truth is not all happy and go lucky. And your book, it shows that, but also your book has a lot of hope and promise. You definitely give some concrete things that people can do, the ballers of the new school, what they can do to help forge, not go to the left or to the right, but a straight path down the middle, which you quote in the book about. So let's start at the beginning here. You start off with a letter to your cousin. And I think that's a beautiful thing because a lot of people, I always speak to people about the youth. You're complaining about them hanging their pants down. You're complaining about them dropping out of school. You're complaining about them standing on the corner. What are you doing to inspire them to move ahead, to inspire them to shift their paradigm, to inspire them to education? And I think by opening your book with that letter is wonderful. Talk to the audience about the letter because I don't want to give everything away, but I want you to talk to them. What are some of the main points in the letter? You're talking about prison. You're talking about education. You're talking about balancing the basketball and sports with male masculinity. Just talk to us about this letter to your cousin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my wife and I were having an interesting argument, not discussion, but she said, you know, look, come on, be honest. The letter was really the impetus behind you writing this book, even though you didn't write the letter first. You know, because of your passion for young folk like yourself and, you know, and even my young cousin. I wrote this letter because my cousin, who, brilliant kid, back when he was, I don't know, maybe about 15, he's in 15 or 16 in high school. He'd always been an honor student. And, you know, he enjoyed sports. And he got pretty good at basketball, and he made the varsity team. Their team happened to win, I think, at least make it to state championship or something like that. But a couple of things happened. One, he got pretty good in sport, but two, the pressure of, you know, being a guy and being popular and believing that there's a certain way in which masculinity is defined through sport physically as opposed to the whole person, particularly the intellectual component, that physical took, you know, precedence. And so his grades began to lapse. So he went from an honor roll student to a C or a C-minus student. And, you know, he spent some, at least one summer with me when he was maybe about 14. Oh, he spent a week one summer with me when he was about 14. And, you know, we played basketball and all this stuff every day. And so I just, you know, I just said, hey, look, you know, I'm writing this letter to you. This is my birthday gift. You know, normally I would send some money or some item. And I said, you know, this letter is my gift to you because I want to have this conversation with you. And it literally was a letter that I'd sent to him, kind of, you know, just trying to, and, you know, I'd been inspired to write that letter because, you know, I'm a big James Baldwin fan. And in his, I'm sorry, my mind is drawing a blank, but.
It's okay. You mentioned him several times in the book. I'll support you in that. You definitely mentioned him several times in the book and the struggle that he had and arts and the purpose.
Right.
Actually, I had a page. I pulled it down. I wanted to read.
Yeah, what does it mean to be a young black man in America? And, you know, and so it was like, okay, that was Baldwin writing to his nephew. And then this is another time, another century, another era. And so I was trying to speak specifically to him. And, you know, of course, not trying to trace Baldwin exactly, but certainly a conversation and just kind of say, hey, man, I understand. I've been there. You know, I know the difficulty of, you know, smart, but also, you know, being interested in being an athlete, you know, being an athlete, but the difficulties of being smart and not being attacked or having that kind of, you know, suddenly this makes you soft, et cetera, et cetera. And so I wrote that to him. And, you know, I mean, the guy's, he's a graduate student in engineering now. I'm not saying that that's the reason for it, but it certainly has an impact. But I really also wrote the letter. The letter wasn't just to him. It was to other young white men, other young men of color, women as well, to young people, just kind of saying, you know, don't forget that while sport is entertainment, you know, there's something that's been infecting our culture, and that's anti-intellectualism. And I just wanted to also remind them that, you know, hey, look, also, you can be involved in this. I mean, I'm involved, and I'm not playing, right? I'm kind of functioning as an intellectual talking about, you know, these activities. But you can be involved in different ways without having to be out there sweating. You can be, you know, and that's why I list a number of different things.
Right. Let me just tell you, Fabini, let me just interrupt you real quick here. People in the chat room are saying they can barely hear you. I'm going to try to call you on your other number.
Oh, really?
You think that might be better?
Can you hear me better now? Is this better? Am I not?
You guys in the chat room, let me know if you can hear him better now.
Can you hear me better
somebody
now?
Just wrote me a note. I'm not sure what they're going
to
say.
I had my phone too far away from my mouth.
Oh, you had too far. Okay, we'll try to bring it closer, and we'll see what we can do. Let's move on a little bit. Now, we talk about the ballers in your second chapter. Actually, before I move on, I just want to read a little something from your first chapter here. And you were talking about the film Finding Forrester. And I think that you kind of gave that as an example of the balancing act that, you know, young men are dealing with. And I can't find the page to turn on. I got a lot of pages turned down in the book. That's why I'm mad at you. You made me work today, okay? You're making me work, okay?
Okay.
So you're letting you know, okay? But anyway, but seriously, in the book, he talks about Finding Forrester as an example of a young brother balancing between, you know, trying to hide his intellectualism. And as you just mentioned, Thabiti, about people not supporting that, you know, because I remember growing up, oh, you speak white, well, you know, or I'm trying to learn, I'm trying to pay attention, oh, you're trying to kiss butt to the teacher. All these things are down, like, people are putting you down. Isn't that what we want to uplift in children? But as a kid, I mean, kids can be horrendous. And this brings me to your own personal experience of racism playing sports on the field, being an excellent athlete against other athletes, and then at 10 years old, talk to the audience about what happens to you, Thabiti. What happens at 10 years old?
Yeah. I give the story of saying that, you know, look, sport is this place where we think, okay, we're going to transcend race and reach these boundaries, I mean, go beyond these boundaries. And, you know, I just recounted the anecdote of when I was when I was 10 years old playing football, and as I was, you know, running, I scored a touchdown, and we were, you know, beating this, and we were playing, I'm from North St. Louis, and so St. Louis, like many cities, pretty racially segregated, And as I was going to give the football to the referee, a little kid called me to use the N-word. And, you know, I was shocked. It stopped me in my tracks. I said it actually tackled me. You know, although they could not, it had tackled me, those words. And just sort of reflecting on, man, where does a kid learn this sort of language, you know? And the response of our coaches, who of a different era were like, you know, that's all right, we're winning the battle on the field. And I was just trying to set up the book and saying, you know, look, this is another generation, and just winning the battle on the field is not good enough for us. You know what I'm saying? And so while
right.
I empathized with my coach, because, you know, their era was we didn't even get a chance to get out here and beat them like you all are beating them. We were like, that's not good enough. But, yeah, so certainly my point was just that, you know, let's not play around and act like, you know, in sport these things are somehow non-existent. And I was using it to say, look, you know, it happens early on. We try and act like it's invisible. And, you know, sport is a microcosm of our society. So, and so that was you know, part of the deal in that regard. But you know, it's funny you mentioned the. Can I just slip back for a second? You mentioned the
sure.
Jamal. You know, that was in the letter to my cousin as I ended. I was just telling, you know, I was telling him be like the character Jamal in Finding Forrester, and just, you know, be able to balance, you know, athleticism and intellectualism, and, you know, really resist what do we call it, hegemony or peer pressure. And, you know, don't
mm-hmm.
use your potential is what I was really kind of saying to him, you know. And I was just trying to remind him of the tradition of, particularly for African-Americans in this country. But, you know, I was like, don't forget Frederick Douglass. This guy wrote his way to freedom. And so
mm-hmm.
you know, we're killed for being illiterate. And now we got young people who, you know, somehow, like you were saying, think being literate or articulate is somehow a bad thing, you know. And so, you know, we have to say that to people and to our young people. And, you know, I was writing a letter, too, to apologize to him and to other young folk like him, saying my generation hasn't done enough. We haven't done enough of our job. And so, you know, you can't begin to critique without looking inward. And so that's part of what this book is doing is I'm saying, look, I'm looking at myself and I'm apologizing and I'm hoping this book and what I'm trying to do with it, you know, what I call my baller movement, is part of it, you know, is part of remedying that those errors.
Let me read from your third chapter here, Original Ballers and New School Ballers. This is one of my favorite chapters. I mean, this is just a serious history lesson. This chapter right here, you got to pick, if nothing else, you got to pick up for this chapter right here, Original Ballers and New School Ballers. One of the people you talk about, Curt Flood. Curt Flood epitomized what it means to be a baller in his 1969 refusal to be traded from St. Louis Cardinals to the Philadelphia Phillies without his consent. Thus, when the Cardinals attempted to trade him, he did the unheard of and sent a letter to Commissioner Bowie Kuhn stating his refusal to exist as property, that he wanted the freedom to play for other clubs the next season, and that the clause was unconstitutional. Talk to the audience about this clause that is stopping him from going to another team at that time.
Well, you're right, and I'm going to begin by explaining that clause, which is when they see free agents in every sport, everybody needs to really call, instead of free agents, they should be calling them Curt Floods. You know, because that's what Curt Flood was arguing for, was free agency. This whole idea that the clause said that, you know, basically that you can't be a free agent. That's I mean, I'm just gonna cut it in that case.
Yeah.
Quick.
Yeah.
That you can't be a free agent. And he was saying, look, I've been, you know, a professional for a certain number of years, and that, you know, I've reached the point now that that contract is over, and I should be able to negotiate where I play, for whom, you know, where I play or for whom and for how much, you know, that there should be a bidding for my services, you know. And basically, you know, our country, one of laws, which we know, just because they're laws don't mean they're just, basically,
exactly.
You know, was supporting the Supreme Court, and they ruled in the favor of the baseball 5-3, and their logic was this sort of liberal use of stare decisis, which was basically a belief that baseball simply could stay the way it is, that, you know, it should stay the way it always has been.
Why are you messing up? See, they were mad at him, too. Why do you keep stirring up the pot? Can't you just
That's
be
right.
happy with
stirring
what you got? You know, that's one of the things you mentioned in your book, is throughout the book from the beginning to end, is, well, why can't you just be happy? The master just gave you a little spot here. You got your little peach. You got your house now. You can live where you want to live. You're on TV. You got your sneaker contracts. Now, just don't put so many tattoos on. Stop wearing the little earring. You know, don't go out with a white woman. I mean, what? You know,
and you
these
know
are
what?
Things that you mentioned in your book.
And this is complicated because on one hand, I'm saying, yeah, these, you know, a lot of these athletes are doing what is not, quote, unquote, seen to be, you know, conservative. But at the same time, I'm also saying that their behavior is not as radical as, you know, let's say white culture or those that control, you know, ideas of what is popular, what is acceptable culture. They're not as
mm-hmm.
radical as we would think. And then at the same
right.
time, I'm also saying to them, look, if you look at this chapter, Original Ballers and New School Ballers, understand what people like Kurt Flood, Jack Johnson, Althea Gibson, you know, Arthur Ashe, what these people have sacrificed and Muhammad Ali and gone through.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand that, then you shouldn't be so like, oh, I don't want to mess up my sneaker contract or, you know, this particular image. You know, you should say, you know what, this is nothing compared to what people have dealt with. And, yes, while there is access, you're still saying in order for me to have this access that I have to act and you know, kind of function a certain way.
A certain way.
I'm trying to remind these, you know, these young men, these women, you know, myself, professionals like myself, yourself, that look, you know, we have to continue. That's why, you know, particularly, you know, black people are still alive, is that we've found creative ways, you know, and been willing sort of go against the grain, because if you follow the you know, the law or follow the rules or you continue to be patient, right,
right.
you never see justice. And don't be fooled into thinking that, you know, because some athlete makes $20 million a year that, you know, that reflects some kind of, you know, that things are better, because we all know the reality, as I point out, of the increased incarceration rates, the enhanced de facto segregation that takes place in school districts throughout the country, right, where
mm-hmm.
it's maybe not legal, but when you go into different schools, you see that it's,
oh, it's
all
definitely
money,
segregated.
All the that's right, and it is separate but unequal,
right,
even in the 21st century. And so, and, you know, I'm saying, you know, look, athletes know where they've come from, and I'm not trying to do in this kind of stereotyping, but a vast number come from poor communities with poor resources, and these notions that, you know, maybe if I become an entertainer, an athlete, that is going to be the way of changing my life. And if you know that, then you know that there's so much that needs to be addressed and dealt with. And so that's why
yeah.
I'm a little critical in some ways. So that's why I'm kind of saying, let's look at this, you know.
Well, that's okay to be critical. That's okay to be critical. We need critical thinkers, because I say the general population have been brainwashed to believe that becoming a basketball player, a football player, and that's one thing you mentioned too, that blacks really only dominate three or four of the major sports. There's a whole plethora of other sports that blacks do not dominate and are not really allowed entry into. But we only have a few. I want to move on a little bit here. Where are the brothers and sisters at? That is a wonderful chapter too. Where are the brothers and sisters at? And in this chapter, you're talking about, we're on the front, on the field, hitting the ball, shooting the ball, swinging. We're doing all those things. But we don't own the teams. We don't coach the teams. And one of the things
we're
that you talk about is people.
Teams. That's right.
We're not running the teams. We're not agents. And other black athletes, you talk about, this is what really poignant. You talk about black athletes not hiring other blacks or people of color or minorities to support them in their career.
Yeah, too few brothers and sisters representing is what I call that little subtopic within the chapter.
Yeah.
Or representing. And I mean representing as in representing the athletes, but also the athletes aren't representing in that they aren't seeking them out. And this comes back to what the book is centered around, this idea of a racial contract. And this is a mindset, right? It's a colonized mindset that somehow, you know, if you hire a person of color to work for you in a professional capacity, they are not going to be able to do the best job. And this is a product of, and I'm, you know, you have me on the show, your racial contract is around these notions of white supremacy, that, you know, white
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, it only functions because it's for there to be a contract, you know, you present something before me and I sign it. I agree. And that they sign the contract that, you know, the best agents are, you know, are the white guys. And I'm thinking, you mean to tell me somebody like myself or many of my friends who are attorneys or what have you, or you couldn't represent you? You're not willing. There's no comfort zone in that regard. I mean, I don't think you hire a person just based on the color of their skin. You know, you have to be competent. But I'm not even going to begin to go into this level of, you know, of trying to justify their competence. I know that there are just as many, if not more, who are competent to perform these jobs, these services.
Well, one of the things you talk about, Floyd Keats, the head of the Black Coaches Association, why is nobody coming to him, banging down his door, saying, you know, well, he could definitely help people, you know, find a coach if they needed one. And, you know, that's one of the issues. One of the things real quick I wanted to mention is you kind of, and this is my interpretation, Grant Hill, Jordan, Tiger Woods, are they the Booker T's? And then you're talking about Charles Barkley, Serena, Venus, Kirk Flood, Terrell, T.O., AI, are they Du Bois, Frederick Douglass? Talk to me.
You know, what I'm really saying is that really based on perception of who kind of fits what people may feel is comfortable and normative, you know, this is a great figure, this is a good person, and just based on these particular appearances, you know. And I don't know if I want to call, you know, Allen Iverson a Du Bois, but I'm saying they certainly reflect this sort of antithesis of what is considered acceptable, palatable sort of cultural perception, right? As far as the way they play and the way one may present themselves, you know, in this particular way, you know, in our society. And so I'm a little hesitant in that regard with Grant Hill because I think that, you know, he's a product of, you know, his parents are, you know, certainly, you know, father an athlete, grew up a certain, you know, a certain, you know, sort of a class status, and so, you know, you kind of function on this level. I just think there's a certain a race neutrality that just is always appealing, even whether that's the case or not, the perception of that. And that's where I'm saying if I have to be considered palatable or race neutral for me to gain a wide appeal, then that shows you that we're not where we say we are, because no one is saying, hey, let's make sure Donald Trump is race neutral. Let's make sure Brett Favre is race neutral. Let's make sure that, you know, that you know, Larry Bird is race neutral. They're saying, no, he's a great white guy. That's the norm. And I'm saying, I think we got to break up these notions of what's norm and what's not. But we do have some athletes that certainly reflect that kind of W.B. Booker. I mean, I look at Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf. I look at
I mean, that was a great example. I mean, we only have a few minutes left, but we're going to have to do another show because you have so much in your book. It's so rich. But one person I definitely want to highlight is Warwick Dunn about Homes for the Holidays. You kind of really highlight him as being, you know, progressive, definitely a true baller of the new school. Helping single moms get homes. You talk about, you know, Lisa Leslie, Cheryl Swoops, and the Williams sisters, you know, breaking barriers for women to be sexual beings but also be excellent athletes, that they can be both. And so there's so much in your book. People have to pick up a copy of his book. Go to the fan webpage, and you'll find out how to get a free copy. I'm going to give away a free copy of your book. Thabita, so sorry that we didn't have more time.
I wish we had more time, but hey, tell people tabitilewis.com and, you know, reach out to me. I'm hoping to extend my book tour. I'll be in Iowa and Kansas City and, you know, hopefully back to Philly, looking for New York. But Ballers of the New School, Race and Sport in America, is the conversation we need to have.
All right. Well, you're going to come back soon because we have so much more to talk about, and we'll continue to talk about helping the youth really be introspective about ourselves and taking a moment to say, hey, there is a problem here in sports. What can we do? And you call to task the athletes, not just holding a little game in the neighborhood, but helping with the education of the youth, providing after-school programs, providing homes like Warwick Dunn, whatever they can do, taking it to the next level, forging a new path, not going left or right. So thank you so much, Thabiti, for doing that, and I wish you much success with the book.
Thank you so much for having me on this show. This is a great opportunity to try and spread the word, and hopefully the athletes will work with people like yourself and myself to use their resources to make those changes.
All right. You have a wonderful Saturday.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.